Hello and welcome back to another episode, another week at The Damage Report on lockdown. And it's Monday, and recently, you know what that means? That means Francesca Fiorentini's here! Francesca! How's it going?
Woo! Woo! One more month. One more month.
You think?
Well, no. I mean, John and I are in Los Angeles, and LA County has extended our shelter in place to May 15th, so I'm just sort of coming to grips with that reality. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm going to descend more into insanity or sort of rise above this, you know.
Could maybe help you career-wise, like wacky comedy.
No, what would help me career-wise is to just become like a right-wing pundit. By the end of this, I'm going to be the next Tommy Lahren.
You think you could do it? You should film one video of you giving it the old college try.
Yeah, and just show how easy it is.
Yeah, it is. Oh, God, it would be so easy. Oh, my God.
Just writes itself.
It does.
How
it
are
does.
You, John?
I'm good. I'm happy you're here. You know, when you just said it would be another month, my initial reaction would be, like, and this is just for me. I'm in a very lucky position where I can do my job from home. I've been given that ability. I have my wife here. I have my dogs here. I'm fine. I'll take another month. I don't really mind that much, honestly. Like, I've been catching up a little bit on reading and stuff. Now, for most people, it is a disaster, potentially. But for me, it's okay. So I'm doing okay. Thank you.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Great.
We've got a lot that we're going to be talking about through the course of today. I did want to say one quick thing as people are coming into the chat. And thank you very much, everybody who's already saying happy birthday, Frenifio.
thank you.
It's very nice of you.
Finally.
I will say, on the Friday show, we had a super chat from a woman who was doing fundraising and wanted to bring it to my attention. And I left a note to myself about that person, but their chat name and their Twitter name are apparently not the same. So I was unable to find that person. So if you are in the chat, please, you know, say something so that I can find you, because I felt really bad. I spent a long time searching on Twitter to find you, and I was not able to, unfortunately. Those of you who are here, please hit the like button. Let more people know about the stream as it's going on. There's a lot that we're going to talk about. There's a lot that I wish we could have talked about. I wanted to talk about Bill Maher. I don't know if you saw what he talked about on Friday, like that we should be doing more time blaming China and it should be called the Chinese virus. Why not? I think that makes sense.
Oh my God. Of course. Once again, Bill Maher needs to be off the air. Cancel Bill Maher. He'll love it because he'll love that cancel culture got him finally. And then he will actually become a right-wing pundit. He almost already is.
See, I think just let him be. It just, like, God, it's getting very predictable and a little bit sad, unfortunately. But that's what we've got. And what we will be talking about is, let's see, viruses. What are they? What did he want the federal response to coronavirus to be initially? What did he think a great strategy was? We also have the New York Times revealing what he knew and what he didn't know and when he either knew or didn't know it, as well as the war on the post office. I will also say just briefly, we were talking about it throughout last week, but if you didn't see, the New York Times did do an article about Joe Biden and the Tara Reid allegations. It's receiving a lot of pushback for some of its I guess the claims that it made in its article and the way that it changed it on social media and stuff like that. So that is available. They're basically reiterating the same information that we've already talked about, but that is out there. And as we predicted, they did wait until after Bernie Sanders left to finally cover that. And I know that they're going to say that they're being diligent and everything, and I'm sure it does take time, but it is an interesting coincidence that Bernie's out and now they feel freed up to actually start talking about it. In any event, with that, you know, feel free to hashtag TDR live us and, you know, chat along and we will get started. Just a couple of days ago, Donald Trump was talking about the challenge that we face from coronavirus, and he had a particularly interesting way of talking about it that I think revealed quite a bit about what he knows and doesn't know about medical science.
Brilliant enemy. They develop drugs like the antibiotics. You see it? Antibiotics used to solve every problem. Now one of the biggest problems the world has is the germ has gotten so brilliant that the antibiotic can't keep up with it. And they're constantly trying to come up with a new. People go to a hospital and they go for a heart operation. That's no problem, but they end up dying from problems. You know the problems I'm talking about. There's a whole genius to it. We're fighting, not only is it hidden, but it's very smart, okay? It's invisible, and it's hidden, but it's very smart. And you see that in a case like a Denver. But, I think we're doing well, and they're on...
Okay. If I had a third grader who talked about medicine in that way, I would not be impressed. I would not be impressed with it's hidden and it's brilliant. There's a brilliance to the germ and it causes, well, problems.
Problems.
You know.
I problems. Feel like if he said that at a rally of his, he's like, you know the problems. People would be like, Mexicans, right?
It causes Mexican problems to your heart.
Right. But this obviously, you know, he thinks that the virus is the same thing as a bacteria. So he doesn't understand the difference between a bacterial infection and a virus. Mm-hmm. And that's, I will say, for me, I also wasn't a grade A, you know, a AP science student.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, I was more of the like, hey, let me copy off your, you know. But listen, viruses don't have ribosomes.
Mm-hmm.
I just Googled that. but I'm not the president. And
you're
they're
not.
Very different things. And yeah, the only thing that can cure a virus is a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if it's the same thing as a cure. But
no, it's supposed
all
to,
I know.
Yeah, it stimulates your immune system into having a sort of preemptive defense for when you're finally exposed to it eventually. And so, like, if he, let's say that coronavirus was a bacteria, that would have been a laughable statement below the dignity of any public official to speak so stupidly about it and to keep using the, like, the hidden and invisible. I don't, what is that? Like, I have thought all along that, is that just designed to get the QAnon people, like, fired up?
Enemy.
Like, we're fighting the hidden enemy, why does he keep saying it's hidden and invisible? It's small. I'll grant you that it is small, but then of course there's the thing with the antibiotics, and as you pointed out, you're not the president, but he is, and this isn't day one of this pandemic. First of all, he's in his 70s, but even if it like, and yes, I get it. I watch a lot of House, so maybe I know a little bit more about this, I suppose. But he is the president, and he is now weeks and weeks into daily meetings, supposedly with Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and other medical professionals. And he still thinks that the issue we have with coronavirus is that our antibiotics are ineffective against it because it's too brilliant for them to work on it. That's insane. Like, can you imagine if Barack Obama had said something so clearly ignorant during an emergency that has killed tens of thousands of Americans, how they would be responding? But I haven't seen anything online from Trump supporters who are like, oh my God, I mean, that's real dumb. Like, you know, I have kids. I've had to care for their health. I mean, what is he giving antibiotics for? Like, just every cut and scrape? Like,
I almost feel like I'm almost sad that Barack Obama wasn't that inept, because if he was, then the right wing would suddenly have to defend science. Do you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
somehow we have to game the other side into making sense by just using reverse logic constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, like, I don't want to make too much out of it. It's just a thing that he said, but it is shocking that he is still so obviously ignorant of basic, and like, when he talks about hydroxychloroquine or when he talks about vaccines, I have to wonder, what does he think he's saying? What are his expectations for what can happen if he is so fundamentally ignorant about what it actually is that is infecting people?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Every day we're learning more about what Donald Trump's initial strategy for dealing with coronavirus was going to be. And we now know that one of his strategies was going to be dealing with it by doing absolutely nothing and letting it wash over the country, killing potentially millions of people. So here are the details. During one task force meeting in the Situation Room last month, Trump turned to Dr. Fauci and challenged him. It was the day the administration was adding Ireland and the UK to its travel restrictions, and Trump wanted to understand why talk of, quote, herd immunity, allowing the coronavirus to sweep a nation largely unchecked with the belief that those who survived would then be immune, was such a bad idea. "Why don't we let this wash over the country?" Trump asked, according to two people familiar with his comments, a question other administration officials say he has raised repeatedly in the Oval Office. Fauci initially seemed confused by the term wash over, but became alarmed once he understood what Trump was asking. Quote, "Mr. President, many people would die," Fauci said. And that many people is, you know, depending on your model, hundreds of thousands or potentially millions of Americans. And he didn't just ask it once, which would have been insane. He repeatedly brought it up. "Why can't we just let this kill a bunch of people? And that's your solution." A solution, conveniently, that doesn't require him to do anything. Certainly he doesn't have to shut down the economy and potentially hurt his reelection chances.
I mean, I do think, and I'm really grateful for people like Dr. Fauci and actual scientists. I mean, I think the one thing this administration needed was someone with their feet in reality. And like most people, I think, all the sycophants that surround Trump would just hear the term wash over and be like, yeah, you know, we all got to wash our hands. Or like, yeah, you know, he means killing everybody. So like, they all take away these different interpretations. No one actually presses him on exactly what he is saying. But then you have doctors and scientists who are like, no, clarify. That's not a scientific term, wash over, right?
It's not.
Do you mean allow the virus to fester and to infect and kill perhaps some 2 million Americans? Because again, this was around the same time that he was getting those figures in.
Yeah. And it's not a scientific term. I haven't heard it used on House. But also, like, think of that as a strategy. Okay, so this thing's going to hit. It's going to kill a lot of people. What's your strategy? Well, let's just let it infect people and not do anything. That is that's the exact thing that we're trying to avoid. That's not even one inch difference between just, well, what if we didn't know that it was out there and just lots of people got sick and lots of people got hospitalized and lots of people died. That was his solution. You put a guy like Donald Trump.
And also someone needs to explain that it's not the chicken pox. Like, just like, exactly. Okay, sir, remember the chicken pox. Right. You know, and then you go through the whole thing. What are the chicken pox? Oh, yeah, that's when, like, the chicken that you get from the store has little blemishes. You're like, no, sir, not that. No. Oh, yeah, that's when the Native Americans were killed up. No, sir, not that. And then explain that it's not the chicken pox. And, I mean, we're seeing right now South Korea this morning, I think, revealed that actually some people who were previously infected or tested positive infected, then were clear, are now testing once again positive. So the herd immunity idea of that even people who were once sick can actually go out. And I think one of the hopes that some people had was that those people who got sick can then be the first responders because they would have been immune to it. It's looking like it's harder to shake than that. Yeah. This is a really dangerous and hard to shake virus. So it's not even based in science as much as we wish it were true.
Yeah. And everyone, again, virus, not bacteria. Pretty important for officials to know. Absolutely devastating. And from what I've read, they're not even sure. Like, some are saying that these people, there, many of them were not re-exposed to it. It was reactivated. And we know of other viruses that can lay dormant and then can come back. Right. Hypothetically, this, we don't know what the limit on that is. Is it that it can come back after a couple of weeks? Can it come back after 6 months, 5 years? We honestly don't know. But we need to learn. We do. Yeah. Now, really fast, when I saw this story over the weekend about the wash over, I remembered, as many of you might have, that this was a term that he had used in public many times. Sometimes he would say wash through, sometimes he would say wash over. So I went back to find some of these videos, and I found one, and I want you to listen to this now. Now that we know what he means by this term, because at the time we did not. Now we know, take a look at this video.
It seems to me that if we do a really good job, we'll not only hold the death down to a level that is much lower than the other way, had we not done a good job, but people are talking about July, August, something like that. So it could be right in that period of time where it washes through. Other people don't like that term, but where it washes through.
Okay, so he says other people don't like that term. We now know what he was thinking when he said that. He was thinking of the many times he's been in the Oval Office and he's used that expression, and they've said, no, you monster, that means hundreds of thousands or millions of people will die. And he said, the evidence that we will have done a good job is when it washes through and will have saved many more lives than in the other way, which we now know would be responding in any way, because his preferred response is to do nothing. And he was talking about it on there. He was thinking about those meetings where people like Dr. Fauci were telling him, no, you obviously can't just let everyone get sick and die unaided. And he was still talking about it, even after being corrected many, many times by people who were not only trying to save lives, but also trying to protect himself, him from himself.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that every time he's given a set of words, it's like me when I'm on the main show and I'm not allowed to swear and all the words are in front of me. Suddenly, I want to say those words. Once again, I am not the president of the United States. But every time someone tells him, hey, do not refer to this virus as the Chinese virus. What was the other thing around Iran? Someone's going to comment about this. There was some other thing that he wasn't supposed to say, and then he immediately said it. He somehow believes that his advisors are just trying to hold him back, you know? They're just trying to restrain his mega alpha brain from just, you know, spitting fire. And that is very scary.
It is. I don't remember that. I do remember the time that he was given a note, don't congratulate. I don't know if it was to Putin or to who. I don't remember. But it was like the one thing. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, famously, we saw his notes from one of these meetings where he crossed out coronavirus and write in China virus or whatever. Mm-hmm. Absolutely insane. And the thing is, like, this sort of story, the idea that the president had to be repeatedly stopped from just surrendering in the face of a pandemic that he was being told would kill a ungodly number of Americans, a World War II of Americans, effectively. It's kind of news. Kind of? A little bit. I'm doing it on Monday. It happened over the weekend that it came out. How many shows are talking about it? Is it all over CNN right now? That he, like, had to be stopped from just disarming in front of it. And it doesn't matter. He'll lose no support. Like, how many Trump supporters would have died as it washed over? Would it have washed over Georgia and Texas and all, like, how many people would have died?
I also keep thinking about the analogy to war, and if this actually is a war, then doctors and nurses and hospital workers and grocers, they are our soldiers, right? They are going to be our vets. They are putting their lives on the line and putting their families at risk. And we're always supposed to venerate those soldiers, and yet he's completely throwing them under the bus. He has total disrespect. We know he actually doesn't respect veterans, but he's definitely not respecting these frontline workers in his so-called invisible war. And I can't imagine, and I know there are people watching, and I know there are people whose family members have either been sick or maybe even passed away or who are working every single day, and I can't imagine trying to get up in the morning and go out to work on this horrible, horrible virus and watch people die and know that your president has no idea what he's talking about and is completely disrespectful of your work. I just want to say that we do respect you and we thank you.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And to see that, like, so I track the numbers every day, and yesterday actually was lower than the previous days. It did start to go down a little bit. It's looking pretty rough so far this morning, but that seems like good news. But I remember like 3 or 4 days ago, they already cut support for the community testing centers. Way premature cut support for it. He's been checked out for like a week and a half now at this point. And like, look, hopefully the measures that a number of responsible governors took will be successful. Hopefully, it seems like people were more responsive to the suggestion to stay home than perhaps the models might have thought that they would be, that people were actually very good about that. It's still a 23,000 Americans have already died. And God only knows when it, like, if it starts reactivating in people, as, you know, the international example seems to indicate that it might, or if we, you know, unlock down prematurely and it starts to spread, perhaps in some areas that it hasn't so far, that might not have stocked up necessarily on the resources that they need. It's just devastating to think about these numbers, and to think that these numbers are still far lower than what some in positions of power, like Donald Trump, were perfectly willing to accept, to even plan to create. Over the weekend, the New York Times gathered multiple warnings that were given to Donald Trump and others in the White House during the initial months as coronavirus was spreading around the world and eventually into the United States. And the glacial pace on the U.S. federal response to it now looks even worse, considering what they knew. I'm not going to go through all of the evidence presented there. The article is available online. You can read it. I will give you a few of the highlights of how specific and repeated these warnings were, though. So first, the National Security Council office responsible for tracking pandemics received intelligence reports in early January predicting the spread of the virus to the U.S., and within weeks was raising options like keeping Americans home from work and shutting down cities the size of Chicago. Mr. Trump would avoid such steps until March. So that is effectively a 8-week delay there. Despite Mr. Trump's denial weeks later, he was told at the time about a January 29th memo produced by his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, laying out in striking detail the potential risks of a coronavirus pandemic, as many as 500,000 deaths and trillions of dollars in economic losses. So you had early January, the pandemic tracking organization saying it's going to hit. You have Peter Navarro saying it's going to hit. Oh, and also it's going to be devastating to the economy. So if you were the sort of politician that doesn't care about human lives, but does care about the NASDAQ, you could have at least responded then preemptively to limit the economic damage. Now, that's not all. But Francesca, I wanted to let you get involved. Multiple different organizations and individuals, including individuals that he really does trust, coming to him, and he just wasn't having it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of that cartoon where, like, I forgot who is just surrounded by a bunch of rakes, and they take a step, and the rake
Sideshow
flies.
Bob.
Yeah, it's Sideshow. That's exactly right. He is Sideshow Bob. What's that cartoon? Very famous. Starts with an S.
South Park.
Yeah, South Park. He is Sideshow Bob trying to get out of, like, the rakes, like, littered around him, like, every single agency telling him, warning him. Early January? Ugh, that one really hurts. And it's like you appointed all of these sycophants to absolutely like be total brown nosers, tell you that you're right whenever you're right or whenever you're wrong, and they're still warning you. Like, you know, if they've broken the like, you know, kowtow barrier that like something is actually up.
Yeah. Yeah. And so here's the thing. Like, And I will say this. And I was saying this, by the way. If you go back and you watch our early coronavirus videos, I kept saying there was no scenario where people were not going to die. And the fact that some people would die is not Donald Trump's fault. The issue was that he waited. When he finally did something, the only thing he did was limit some travel, generally from countries that he's been trying to limit the travel from anyway. He keeps referring to that as if that was the only thing that needed to be done, and that he should be given credit despite the fact that over 500,000 people in America have coronavirus. That was never going to be enough. What you needed to do was start as early as possible, to start stockpiling personal protective equipment, ventilators, and testing kits, and start distributing them to each city, if possible, to regional distribution centers, if necessary, so that when it did get here, inevitably, you would be able to respond as quickly as possible. And you wouldn't have situations where doctors were starting to independently come to the realization that coronavirus had hit their area, but they weren't authorized to actually test for it, nor were they given the tests necessary to actually actually do so. And you could have planned preemptively for social distancing measures to be authorized nationwide. Now, he can't force states to do that, but he could put pressure on them. He could certainly advise Republicans to do so, which would almost certainly have been successful. He could have done all of that, and that would have drastically limited how many people needed to die. These are not impossible to come up with scenarios. He was being advised about all of this. It was 100% possible, and those 23,000 dead Americans, that number could be far, far lower.
Yeah, and I think the real thing for me is his fixation on the economy and how the economy was going to take a hit. And this is the problem with running your country like a business. It's the problem with surrounding yourself with Wall Street executives and former Wall Street folks who only care about stock portfolios, is that it's, yes, there is a coming economic crisis. There is no way around that. So what do you do? How do you deal with it? How do you plan to have a country and a government that is responsible to people and preserving human lives and taking care of them and also making sure your economy doesn't tank? Well, now we basically have both. Why? Because workers can't actually go out and do their jobs because people are being, they're losing their jobs, 17 million of whom have already applied for unemployment insurance. Meanwhile, in countries like Europe and other countries who have more of a social safety net, who have more planning, who don't base everything around the fallacy of the stock market and how well it's doing, they're actually way better because they have more of a planned economy and just more of a plan generally.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Two quick things. One, I know that Sideshow Bob is from Simpsons. South Park was a joke. So I see people in the chat who don't seem to understand that.
Yeah, it's a joke.
The second one, so I want to respond to this. So Ernie sent in a comment saying, supposedly Trump is our leader. So yes, John, it is his fault for even one death caused by COVID-19. That's what leader's job is. No, but like, okay, I suppose technically on some level, but I'm saying it would be an impossible standard to have to say that he could have stopped nobody, literally anybody from dying. And I know I'm supposed to have Trump derangement syndrome. I'm supposed to be attacking him unfairly at every possible turn. Why are you so obsessed with me? No, I've been saying from the very beginning, some number would die, but I'm going to judge him on what he says and what he does and what he doesn't say and what he doesn't do. And he has given us even more ammunition in that area than I could have possibly imagined. That even now, he's still fighting back against the advice of medical experts. He tweeted earlier today that governors, the idea that it's not up to him on when states resume their economy is false, that he can just force them to, that's not true remotely. That's not even close to true. But he's still, it's like, Now that we see this New York Times thing, and there's more, there's a warning from Alex Azar about the possibility of a pandemic. It's January 3rd, second warning in 2 weeks he'd given. Trump apparently called Azar an alarmist. This is back in January. When Trump finally agreed in mid-March to recommend social distancing across the country, they said his closest associates said that he was shell-shocked and deflated. One described him as subdued and baffled by how the crisis progressed, even though he had been warned way in advance of the crisis in America, at least, of how it would proceed. But he was still baffled. It paints a picture where it seems like it was the perfect storm. You could not have chosen a person who would do more to harm the federal response, to be more petulant and personalize it and, you know, create these unnecessary clashes of personality with people inside of the administration and governors as well. He was the perfect person to limit our ability to limit loss of life. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say to this Trump derangement syndrome, like, I know you mentioned that in passing, but it is very fitting, though, that, like, at a time when none of us can really leave our homes and we're forced to watch the news and watch the president, it's almost like we are, I mean, it's making everything very stark for me, and it's making things very stark for November. And I don't want to talk about electoral politics, but it's like we have to sit and watch this train wreck in live, slow motion, day by day. And I think that's important. I think it's important for us to look at who this guy is and how bad he is. He's been this bad all along, but this is one of those challenges that, again, in every single way he's failing. And I think it's important that we take a look at that. I had something else to say, and now it's escaped me. Oh, I was going to say this. The New York Times article, I thought the part that that really struck me was that the only person who could get through to him, right? All these warnings from all these different heads, department heads, the only person who got through to him was Deborah Birx from the CDC, right? Mm-hmm. And because he thought she was, quote, elegant. Swear to God, that's what, that she was soft-spoken. And this was some of her, his advisors think that Deborah Birx was finally paid attention to by Trump because she was soft-spoken and she was, quote, elegant. Like, that is the level we're dealing with. Like, just wrap it up in a nice scarf, mm-hmm. you know, make it blonde, and he will listen.
Yeah.
Like, we have the Bugs Bunny of presidents.
That's true.
Or the Bugs Bunny enemy of presidents. You're like, just dress up like a mop with like a...
exactly. Like, or when he goes as Lady Bunny. Yeah. Yeah, I... He is more elegant that way. Yeah, it's sad. It's just sad. By the way, we should say, I think it's only fair to say that Trump denies this story. He tweeted, the New York Times story is a fake with a capital F, just like the paper itself, in which you, if you're listening to the podcast, you can't tell, but paper is in quotation marks. I think he's denying that the New York Times is printed on actual paper.
Mm-hmm.
He continues, sort of, I was criticized for moving too fast when I issued the China ban, long before most others wanted to do so. Secretary Azar told me nothing until later, and Peter Navarro memo was same as ban. I don't know what same as ban is. Fake news. So he's denying that he had those conversations. I'm going to assume that they had good evidence when they wrote it. And he continues to say that any criticism of his response on coronavirus is invalid if he tried to ban travel from China and if anyone disagreed with him on doing that. If either or both of those things are true, then it doesn't matter anything else he did or didn't do, which I find unacceptable. And I know that this is probably evidence of Trump derangement syndrome, but if I have to spend some number of minutes on every damage report between now and when he finally blessedly leaves public life, I am not going to let him get away with rewriting history about what he did as the pandemic was bearing down on America and all of the people unnecessarily who had to die as a result of that. I've been watching, I mean, if you follow enough people on Twitter, you've probably seen any number of people tweeting about the individuals they know who've passed away from it. I just saw there was a young woman, I believe she was 19 years old, that worked in a grocery store, and she had to continue working because she didn't have the money to stop, even though they weren't offering hand sanitizer, gloves, or masks. So she did her job in incredibly dangerous circumstances, and she eventually died of coronavirus. She did not have to die of coronavirus. She just didn't. She was betrayed by the people who owned that supermarket. She was betrayed by her government as well. Either one of those could have stepped in and saved her life. And that is just one. When you look at that 23,000, which is going to increase by, you know, 1,500 today, each one of those is a tragedy that didn't need to happen.
Absolutely.
Lots of news has broken over the last weekend of how much information Donald Trump ignored in the initial weeks as coronavirus spread across America. And so the question is, if we had responded more aggressively or aggressively at all, could lives have been saved? Now, that's one question for me to ask, I guess. But Jake Tapper asked it of Dr. Fauci, and here's what he had to say.
Do you think lives could have been saved if social distancing, physical distancing, stay-at-home measures had started third week of February instead of mid-March?
You know, Jake, again, it's the what would have, what could have. It's very difficult to go back and say that. I mean, obviously, you could logically say that if you had a process that was ongoing and you started mitigation earlier, you could have saved lives. Obviously, no one is going to deny that. But what goes into those kinds of decisions is complicated. But you're right. I mean, obviously, if we had right from the very beginning shut everything down, it may have been a little bit different, but there was a lot of pushback about shutting things down back then.
So look, he's being a little bit careful in the beginning with his language,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think he's being incredibly careful.
Yeah,
in fact, I think what's staggering about that clip is how careful he's trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he says he has like three different qualifying, like, you know, I mean, it's hard. The decisions are hard, but sure. of course it would have been less, you know, there would have been fewer deaths and it would have been better. But like, he keeps on qualifying it, which shows that he is actually very scared to contradict or make it look like this president did anything wrong.
Yeah, and look, he gives all the qualifications, but the interesting thing is one qualification that he gives at the end when he's like, okay, fine, yes, I admit, if we'd been more aggressive, if we'd locked things down as he was being instructed to, lives could have been saved, but there was a lot of pushback. I don't remember exactly what word he said, but it was effectively like there was a lot of pushback, which is one thing to say, but we know who was providing that pushback. The most important person, Donald Trump, was providing the pushback. And more importantly than us knowing that, Donald Trump knows that. And so he's gonna see that Fauci video, and he's not gonna like Fauci admitting that people, that lives could have been saved, even though it's the most obvious thing in the world. You shouldn't need Dr. Fauci to tell you that. But when he says that there was pushback, and he knows that it was him, because regardless of what he says, you know, in front of the podium or whatever, he knows what he did, and he knows what he said, and he knows what people's response is, well, he's not gonna like it. And apparently, indeed, he didn't like it, because he went on Twitter and he retweeted a tweet that included the hashtag #FireFauci. Now, look, it's possible that he didn't realize what he was retweeting, but he knew what he was retweeting. And so #FireFauci is trending. And that, look, this is not the same thing as him actually firing him, but he is encouraging the social media pressure against Dr. Fauci for committing the crime of admitting what is true when the right wing, you know, God Emperor Donald Trump has said otherwise.
This guy, I mean, this is the other thing about being baited on Twitter, is that he's not only baited by the opposition and people who hate him, he's baited by his own base. I mean, he's the definition of just a moralist blowhard. I mean, and this is the thing that, you know, like, that I'm sure that person was like, geez, I didn't mean to get this retweeted. You know, like, I was just trying to, you know, call him a cuck or whatever. Like, I just feel like this is what's so scary about this administration, is it's this, like, you know, 4chan to White House pipeline that goes through Breitbart and then Fox News and then goes right to, you know, the president himself. Or you just skip all those steps and you straight up have him retweeting things like this.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we saw that over the last 2 weeks when I think we might have talked about on... maybe on Monday, did we talk about the diamond and silk, the number of deaths is being invented? It's just being made up?
No.
I don't know if that was us. But anyway, they said it 2 weeks ago. And last week, it was just all Fox News. All the opinion people, their straight news people. Not every single one of them. I don't think Chris Wallace has said it. But, and maybe not Brett Baer. But virtually
he's
all of the...
there.
Virtually all of the others have now said the numbers are being either artificially inflated or they're just based on nothing, or because it's lower than an estimate that was given, we shouldn't care at all. That's Tucker Carlson's thing. If, you know, he said on one day that it's not as bad as they said it would be, on the day that the numbers jumped up to 2,000 and stayed there for 3 days, that was his bold stance that he decided to take. And they've all now agreed that, you know, a couple thousand Americans dying every single day is not that big of a deal. Why are we freaking out about it? But anyway, yeah. I'm curious for the people in the audience, I'd like to see just your gut feeling. Does Fauci, this is a question I'm going to ask you, does Fauci last the week? If you believe that he does last the week, I want you to put a 1 in the comment section. If you believe he's going to be canned before the end of the week, put a 2. It's just trending, you know, and he hasn't himself put a hashtag fire Fauci, but obviously it's on his mind if he's retweeting that. So give me the 1s and 2s and we'll see what you think about Fauci being willing to admit that that pressure was probably coming from inside the house. And while those are coming in, Mark Davis sent us a super chat. Hi from nowhere, Kansas, home of the Spanish flu, which is funny because are you familiar with what he's referencing there, Francesca?
No, I just laughed.
Okay,
anyway.
Well, it is funny anyway. But so the response to anyone who's like, hey, Asian Americans are getting harassed and assaulted all over the place, maybe you could chill with the China flu thing,
right,
is, hey, they called it the Spanish flu before and nobody had a problem. Because, first of all, because what was acceptable in 1918 is acceptable now for some
reason.
Sure.
I mean, yeah.
And second of all, it didn't start in Spain. That was propaganda. There is a chance it actually started in Kansas. That's the belief. So it was propaganda at the time.
Yeah.
I am seeing a mix of 1s and 2s. So Fauci, you know, maybe update your resume, you know, get your LinkedIn, you know, polished, you might be heading out.
I mean, this is, he goes the same way if he leaves as so many different officials in the Trump administration who are faced with that moral crisis. I mean, some of them can go F themselves, but, you know, others who try to do good are like, I'm between trying to make a 2-year-old understand that there are lives at stake and also being an honest act, like actually being integrous. And I think you see that in Fauci's response. And you see that, I mean, the fact that he's staying on, he could quit. He could absolutely quit because he's been ignored. So he's in the right to actually leave, if anyone, yeah. Because you know that if anything goes wrong, if Trump starts to say that his response was, you know, that this is actually bad, that like he's been advised poorly, he's going to blame Dr. Fauci.
Yeah. And I don't know, like as I'm thinking about the possibility, because there have been past times in the past few weeks where we thought he might be about to be fired. There's sort of. Like, if he gets fired, then he might, in theory, be freed up to give us more information about his conversations with Donald Trump, which would be scary, but probably wouldn't actually change anything. The issue is that he has seemed more successful than most in being able to at least a little bit nudge Donald Trump in the right direction. That power might be waning, but in terms of shutting down the Easter, you know, relaunch of the economy, he seems to have been important there. By the way, on the day that Donald Trump was saying, you know, damn the torpedoes, we're going to reopen the economy, like over 1,500 Americans died that day on Easter. So that would have been a great idea. And yeah, I don't know. I hope that he doesn't. Anyone who has influence and who doesn't seem like an absolute monster in the White House needs to remain there as long as they can, I think. There have been any number of different corporations and groups that are being bailed out already through legislation that's passed or that are planned to be bailed out in the near future. But one so far that has received limited support is the post office, which has been a target of Donald Trump and right-wingers for some time. And right now, they are very much in need. The Postal Service is calling on Congress to provide $75 billion in cash, grants, and loans. But President Donald Trump is standing in the way of any relief funding for USPS. He recently threatened to veto the $2 trillion Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act if the legislation contained any money directed to bail out the postal agency, according to a senior Trump administration official and a congressional official. So what they ended up doing was there was this back and forth with, I believe it was Mnuchin, over the amount that could be given just in a loan. No actual, just no strings attached money, which every industry is getting. Like if you're running Carnival Cruises, they're giving you billions of dollars because that's essential. But the Postal Service, that can just die, hypothetically. And so they got a loan, basically. But right now it's projecting that they're going to lose $2 billion each month because, you know, they're going to have to continue to serve. And by the way, more people are going to be using the Postal Service to have things delivered, while at the same time, they're not being substantially assisted by our government.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think some of the like learning more about the Postal Service is super interesting because of how, you know, the federal government, especially under, well, particularly under Republicans, it's like, where is the last vestige where we can make money? You know, like, we've already gutted the Department of Education where charter schools are on the rise, right? Like what's left? Like, let's take the Postal Service, like of all the things, you know? And the other thing that makes no sense about this is Trump's number one enemy, ostensibly, is Jeff Bezos. He hates Bezos. He hates Bezos because of the Washington Post. He hates Bezos, you know, I don't know. It's like the only time where he and Bernie Sanders somewhat align, although he's going to try to martyr Sanders in the general. And like, it's like, oh, you want to go against Bezos? The USPS helps. Like you need to make, you have the countervailing force to Amazon at your fingertips. Give it some goddamn money. And the other thing to know is that apparently the post office hasn't been taking federal funds for decades. Like, they have all these stipulations on their money. So actually, they really rely on you buying stamps, and mostly your mom and your grandma and the cute little springtime stamps that they buy, which we think is so silly, but we totally raid their stamp collection when we visit them.
Yeah.
So, they haven't been taking federal funds for a long time. So they've been losing money for many, many years.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the stamps, because now as sort of a protest, lots of people are apparently going out and buying a bunch of stamps. But I'm glad that you brought up Amazon, because, you know, I found references back in 2018 to him creating a task force to try to destroy the Postal Service as he was tweeting constantly about Amazon back then. I mean, he has a far more personal reason to want to destroy it, but it's not new. I mean, right-wingers have been trying to do it, even though I do want you to bear in mind, the interesting thing is that the right wing, which loves the Constitution, believes that we should take the, you know, the raw text of the Constitution and never change it or update it, seem to be ignoring the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 part that says the U.S. government has the power to establish post offices and post roads. Nope, we should give that to some private corporation and just privatize it, which they 100% want to do and plan to. The good thing is that right now there are a lot of good politicians, including some of the best progressives in the country, who are fighting back against this. AOC was tweeting about the 2006 Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. That's where they made the change that effectively created these new onerous requirements when it came to funding pensions, which were designed to bankrupt it over time. So what do you know? They're losing money a decade and a half after. And, you know, Bernie Sanders tweeted, we cannot allow Donald Trump to use this horrific pandemic as an opportunity to bankrupt and privatize the Postal Service. Now more than ever, we need a strong and vibrant Postal Service to deliver mail 6 days a week. Congress must act now to save it. And I mean, there are so many jobs, like the people who work for the Postal Service, 500 have tested positive for coronavirus. There's nearly 500 more that are presumed positive. 19 have died. And so, again, this is one of those groups that is on the front lines, interacting with people, touching people. They're out there trying to help us maintain some semblance of a life. And Republicans are, as in so many areas, trying to use this opportunity to accomplish the goals that they came into the crisis with.
Yeah. And I do think, like, there is something that each American can do in this case. I remember I was in a line at the post office, which was no more than 10 minutes at most, maybe even like it was less than that. And a guy behind me waits for like 30 seconds and then is like, oh, this is BS, and then leaves. And it's like, this is what I'm saying. And I'm sure he hates Trump, and I'm sure he voted Democrat. But then show it with your money and your patience and your time. Don't just, like, as a, you know, reaction and sort of a, you know, Pavlovian thing, go to Amazon to buy what you need, right? You can support the post office. You can go and mail packages through them. I do believe they have pickup services, right? They come to your mailbox and get your letters. Like, so just to say, like, let's all remember that there is something we can do to support the post office.
Yeah.
If we can sacrifice a little bit of, like, minimal less convenience. You don't need everything in 2 days, okay? I know you don't.
The people who get so frustrated, like, in the post office, it's never that long. Honestly, I don't even think the DMV, like, you have the most advanced entertainment technology that's ever been created in your hand. I don't mean hypothetically. I mean literally. All of you have your phone in your hand right now. And you are always looking for opportunities to bring it out and look at it. How about a 10-minute wait at the post office? Seems like a perfectly good opportunity to watch a Quibi or whatever. Like, you know that you want to use your phone. Stop. Like, people want to be entertained, but they also want to complain, I think. Right. Yeah. Nobody gets to be bored anymore. There's a billion books being written literally this second. Go on Instagram. You know how many hot people are on Instagram? All of them. All of them are on there. Instagram. You don't get to be bored. Do something. Come November, if there was one politician we could get rid of, perhaps the only second to Donald Trump would, of course, be Mitch McConnell, someone who has done more individual damage to our country over the past few years than virtually anyone else in D.C. or outside of it. And so we're going to need the right sort of candidate to take on Mitch McConnell come November. And we have one candidate fighting it out to be the guy who takes on Mitch, who joins us now. This is a candidate, Mike Breuer, welcome to the Damage Report.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. This is the first time that we're talking about your race. So for people in our audience who might not be familiar with your background, tell us a little bit about what you were doing before you entered the field of politics.
I was farming. I was farming here in Kentucky for the last 15 years. I'm a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, married to a retired Marine, and we met out in California on active duty and found out that we were both interested in farming, sustainable agriculture, and so we bought a farm here when I retired in 2005, and we've been farming here and kind of minding our own business. But along the line, we did a couple other things. My wife got deployed to Afghanistan. I subsequently went as a defense contractor. Our son went as defense contractor to Afghanistan, so we're 100% on the forever wars. But I was the a reporter and then editor of the third oldest newspaper in Kentucky, the Interior Journal, a rural weekly. But we've tried a bunch of stuff here on the farm, and but 10 years ago, we settled on all natural asparagus. And just this last Friday, we delivered our first annual load for the Lexington, Kentucky Farmers Market. So we are in the midst of it here.
So you've said before in appearances that I've seen that you didn't have any sort of lifelong burning desire to enter politics, that you've been in a couple of the other most important fields in service to our country, in the military, in the media as well. So why now? What is it about this particular time that has led you to consider political office?
Well, it was the slow realization that Donald Trump is a symptom, and Mitch McConnell and his ilk are the real problem. And they enable Trump. They have got this transactional relationship with him, as he gets to do whatever he wants, not held accountable, and they get to get rich and pack the courts, which is their legacy. Well, and watching that and this realization, and as a Kentuckian, and with the election coming up, I looked at people who've run against Mitch McConnell in the past, and we've run nice middle of the road Kentucky politicians at him, and they've run as centrists, kind of Republican lights, and they get creamed every time. And so I looked at my resume as a farmer, and as an educator, and as a retired combat veteran, and I said, he's never run against anyone like you before, and so I'm running at him as a straight-up progressive from the grassroots Kentucky.
So in terms of some of the aspects of your platform, I saw one thing that you're supporting is some form of UBI. That's a policy that obviously Andrew Yang did a great deal of work in helping to popularize, and has now become very common that you're hearing politicians talk about it as, you know, the response to coronavirus continues. What do you think the sort of long-term prospects for UBI coming out of this? Is this going to be something that sort of we dabble in but then move past? Or do you think that this will give people a taste of the policy that they might want to see in a recurring way?
Well, I think if we've learned anything to this point from the pandemic is how wrongly emphasized our economic system is. We pegged the success of what we judge as the healthy economy on the stock market and not on, you know, the lives of the people who work and the poor and the middle class of this country. And so I see a long-term future for universal basic income as well as universal health care, because, you know, in the last 10 weeks, we've seen how fragile these systems are, and they're not surviving the stress test. So, I was speaking to a group of young Democrats here in Kentucky last Sunday, virtually, of course, and I told them the great tragedy of this pandemic after the loss of life will be if we rush back to the comfort of business as usual. And, we added over 6 million people to the unemployment rolls last week, possibly 6 million families now without health insurance, facing this huge health crisis. We cannot rush back to business as usual in this country.
Yeah. And, potentially another 3 to 6 million this week. No reason yet to believe that it won't look that way. Yeah. And so you mentioned meeting virtually. I'm curious. I mean, you're running in a statewide race. How are you adapting to the fact that you can't travel all around knocking on doors?
Well, I have to give all due credit to my campaign team. When Andrew Yang shuttered his presidential campaign, a lot of his national staff came here to work for me in Kentucky. And they have a adapted seamlessly to me as the candidate. Of course, there's a lot of work on the back end, but and so we've done all kinds of things. We're facilitating. In fact, tonight I've got a meeting with County Democratic Party that my team is facilitating. You know, the digitally every night I do a live stream at 7 o'clock, and we have great guests on. You know, we had Scott Santons come on. We've got Kentucky's own Matt Jones, who's just written a book called Mitch Please. He's going to be on Tuesday night. And we get, and I know this isn't big numbers compared to what you guys get, but we get 2,000 people a night watching, which ain't bad. That's for awesome. A guy sitting on his farm. Yeah, it's good. And then the other thing I do is that we just have a bunch of interviews stacked up with, and in Kentucky, rural weekly and rural newspapers and local radio outlets are still very, very popular. And so, you know, my day is stacked up with doing interviews, talking to people on the phone, and of course, getting ready to do our nightly live stream we call Chicken Whistle Live.
That sounds awesome. That sounds actually like a lot of fun, and people could certainly use some fun considering what's going on.
Consider yourself invited.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. So you're running in Kentucky. Obviously, the target is on Mitch McConnell, but you do have to make it through your primary first. And so I want to talk about your competition at both levels. So a number of people running. Amy McGrath is considered sort of like the biggest name that's running right now. Tell me about some of the things that differentiate you and Amy.
Well, you know, when I talked about the kind of people who've run against Mitch McConnell before, that's where she's running. You know, as trying to appeal to this squishy middle, it's not working. You know, when she ran in 2018 in the 6th congressional district, and she ran as the most progressive for this left person in Kentucky. And now her newest incarnation running against Mitch McConnell, you know, she said that she would have voted to seat Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. She says that Mitch McConnell stopping Donald Trump from draining the swamp. So, you know, her policies that you can find are all kind of mushy, middle of the road, not very exciting. A lot of, well, we need to have a conversation about that. We need to explore that, and nothing hard. And I am, you know, this is time to excite the base. This is time to stand for something. So, you know, I'm running as who I am, letting it all hang out. I put my policies on the website back in August and have let everyone take a look at them and take a whack at them. And so, I think the battle for ideas with the McGrath campaign is long since over, particularly with the advent of the pandemic. Of course, there's this canard that she's the front runner. She's a front runner money only. She was recruited by the DSCC, by Chuck Schumer. She gets all the outside money. But those people don't get to vote in Kentucky, and people in Kentucky are flat on her.
Are you expecting any direct debates? I mean, I guess they would be virtual at this point, but debates inside of the primary?
Well, we had our last town hall about 7 weeks ago. It was the last time, and you know, it's funny. It was in Northern Kentucky, run by Indivisible. It was great venue, great event, and after her performance that night, everyone said, you'll never see her again. And because it was terrible. And so, like, for example, Kentucky National Organization for Women had a candidate forum scheduled. And of course, it was the pandemic shut down the public meeting. And they said, hey, let's just do this virtually. And none of the other candidates said they would do it. And I said, well, hell, I'll do it. And so Kentucky National Organization for Women, instead of canceling, said, okay, we'll give Breuer the whole hour. And literally, so the Kentucky National Organization for Women's candidate forum consisted of me fielding answers from their membership for an hour. And it was awesome.
And it's 9 people you're running against right now? Not one was willing to go against you in that?
9 to myself.
Wow. Okay. That is something. So on Mitch McConnell, he's held the seat since 1984. And at least recently, he's been one of the most hated political figures in the country. So in terms of how you're crafting your strategy against him, how does he keep winning when he is so hated? Is he not hated in Kentucky? Is there something he's doing that the Republicans there just love? What do you attribute his success to over the years? Is it the sorts of candidates that are challenging him?
Well, you're right. You know, he has got the ability to parachute some pork in during an election year. You know, everyone the joke here is you don't have to look at the calendar. You know, when Mitch shows up with a highway bypass, then it's an election year coming up. But particularly with his wife as the Secretary of Transportation, you can double down on that. But and of course, in the past, if you run as Republican light against a Republican, the Democratic base does not get excited. You know, actually, there are more Democratic voters in Kentucky, registered voters in Kentucky, than Republicans. And so if you cannot excite them, and if you give them a choice between a Republican or a Republican light, the Democrats stay home and everyone else votes for the Republican anyways. So a little bit is on about us as Democrats here in Kentucky. And then the other half is, you know, he can deliver some pork, particularly in an election year.
And, you know, we've sort of like walked around this a little bit through the course of the interview. But obviously, like nationally, when people think about, you know, figures that are doing damage, Trump certainly takes up a lot of the oxygen in the room. He's the biggest figure. Do you think that a case could be made that Mitch McConnell over the past, you know, 3+ years has been in the same ballpark in terms of the effect that he's had on the country?
Well, I mean, I know you expect me to say worse, so I'm going to say worse, but I really believe it. You know, he rare moments of truth from Mitch McConnell. You know, about a year ago, he was speaking to a group here in Kentucky, and he was talking about federal judges. And he said, "I am changing America forever." And he was. I mean, and so even if we replace Donald Trump, even if we maintain the House, even if we flip the Senate, these 140 plus federal judges with lifetime appointments that they've rammed through, you know, people the ABA says are unqualified and they're ideologically driven and they owe their allegiance to people like McConnell. And the damage that Mitch McConnell's caused to the Republic and to the Constitution is going to last probably for the rest of my life.
Wow. Well, hopefully some of that damage can be limited by the right candidate beating him in November. Mike, where can people find out more about your campaign and possibly join one of your virtual hangouts?
The best place to start, of course, is my website, mikeforky.com, mikeforky.com. From there, there's links to, you know, all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, a bunch of great videos on YouTube, but you can reach them off the Facebook page. And then from there, if you go to the Facebook site, that's a great launching point to see our 7 p.m. live stream every night except for tonight, called Chicken Bristle Live. And it's been a lot of fun doing it. And we get great questions. We field questions live. I love the question and answer. Keeps you on your toes, makes you smart. And so mikeforky.com is a place to start.
Awesome. Mike Breuer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.